For the record, that was the first thing you said on the recording.
So I have this kind of feeling that kind of everyone on this retreat is practicing well and you know, relatively speaking, content and happy, and I find this a little bit disturbing. I prefer a little bit more distress. Sort of feeling of existential doom and anxiety is kind of the thing that I'm aiming for. So so what I might do in this talk this morning, I'll change this, so change up the format a little bit and do a bit more of a substantial talk this morning, but I won't talk directly about meditation so much as attempting to induce nightmares. Now, so who likes horror movies? Who likes horror movies? Why do you like horror movies? Why do you like horror movies?
They're very stimulating.
I don't know. I was...
You don't analyze it too much.
No, but when I was a child, I watched a lot of them, and a psychologist commented that it was like a way to deal with sexual repression.
Uh-huh. Thank you. That's very, very interesting.
Okay.
They make us feel safe because.
Right. Because you get out alive, right? Yeah. So. Does it sometimes feel that when you look at the world today that we're actually like living inside a horror movie? Mm-hmm. No?
Science fiction.
Science fiction?
Yeah.
They're pretty dystopian versions, right?
Yeah.
Difficult to like write science fiction these days, because by the time you finish writing the book, something more horrible has happened than you possibly ever imagined. So I want to talk this morning a little bit about storytelling, and this is something that I have always been interested in, and it's something that I believe is an important part of Buddhist tradition, but tends to get ignored in modern Buddhism for whatever reason. We either have people who take Buddhist stories and kind of insist that they are sort of just facts and truth and history. That's very boring and fundamentalist. Or you have people who like will often just dismiss the stories and don't pay attention to them. Oh, that's just myths, that didn't really happen. And so neither of those people are really listening to what the stories are saying. But I think if we listen to them carefully, we can hear that there's a reason why in the Buddhist tradition there's been an accumulation of literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of stories. Not stories which were taught by the Buddha, not stories which were necessarily found in the earliest Buddhist scriptures, but stories which the Buddhist community felt the need to tell itself. And often you find in these stories that they tell kinds of things that we don't necessarily hear in the doctrines. For example, you often hear a lot about the voices of women and the experiences of women in the stories. When I began doing serious research into bhikkhuni ordination, one of the things that I noticed was that when the men, the monks in positions of power, patriarchs, when they gave their reasons why bhikkhuni shouldn't exist, one monk in Thailand literally wrote a book with the title Problems with Bhikkhunis. Well, this is going to be a fair-minded examination of the And then there's all these kinds of legal and rational arguments which are given. And you sort of get diverted into thinking that this is a kind of a legal problem or a rational problem. Of course, the fact that, you know, powerful men sitting around debating what women should be doing without ever actually thinking to ask a woman what she might think about what she should be doing seems to escape their attention. And there's been a long time since I realized that these things, that this kind of rational veneer is really hiding something which is much weirder and much more interesting. And so these days, I don't really sort of get into these kinds of legalistic debates about sort of becoming ordination and these kinds of things. In fact, the last time it came up on our forum, somebody posted some patriarch who had another sexist rant about how there's some legal reason why bikinis can't exist. So my response was to post a clip from the She's a Witch clip from Monty Python. Because that's basically what it is, right? Basically, you come to the conclusion that she's a witch, and so your only problem is how do we get there, right? So you have to sort of figure out some kind of way of proving your point. So that's, I think, about the kind of level of the logical analysis that's required at that point. But which leaves aside the question, why is this thing happening? You know, all these things have gone on, and I find that people like in Buddhism, they don't really, a lot of times they don't really sort of grapple with what the meaning of it is and what's really happening. So anyway, what I found was when looking at this was that there, in these Buddhist stories, particularly in this class of stories that we call the Jataka stories, the life of the Buddha, many other kinds of stories we have, and that they say things and talk about things in a different way, which give us a different perspective. And I've learned a lot from this. And I'd like to share some of those things with you today. Now, the nature of storytelling is elliptical and elusive and unclear. I'm not going to give you a didactic story which is going to tell you what to think, okay? So anybody who comes to me looking for a straightforward answer to a straightforward question is likely to be disappointed, okay? What I want to do is to try to take you, if you're interested, on a bit of a journey, and a journey that you may well feel lost on, but in feeling lost, you're probably feeling like a lot of the characters in that story. Okay, so let's consider what the idea of a myth is. Now, these days, when people think about myth, they usually think about Mythbusters or something like that, right? So myth is something which you think is true, but turns out to be myth-taken. Right? That's what people think a myth is. But that is not really what a myth means, especially the kind of proper study of myth is essentially a sacred story. Right? So a sacred story is a story which crucially, a people tell. It's not a story, it's not a novel, which a certain individual tells. So we're used to individualistic storytelling. A myth is a kind of communal storytelling. It's a story that people tell, created and passed down through many hands. And it tells the story of that people, and it tells the story of who they are. So it's a story that creates a sense of identity. Okay. Now, the oldest myth, or true hero myth that we have is the story of Gilgamesh, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Is anyone here familiar with Gilgamesh at all? Huh? But Gilgamesh is a amazing story, lots of rich kind of things in it, being kind of pieced together from lots of different versions and different clay tablets and so on and so forth. But one of the critical, that's from, I think it was from Babylon, like 2000 BC or something like that. But, you know, prevalent in the culture a long time, and believed even Hercules was a sort of version of Gilgamesh. Anyway, so Gilgamesh was a king who wanted to establish his kingship. He had a mate called Enkidu, and Gilgamesh and Enkidu were best buddies, and they did everything together. And in case you're wondering, yes, the whole thing is hella gay. So Gilgamesh and Enkidu set out to go, they want to build a new capital, a new palace. And so they set out to chop down the forests of, the cedar forests of Lebanon. They need wood to build their city. And so they go out into the forest, and in the forest they encounter a monster, a spirit of the forest, who rejoices in the name of Humbaba. And so they encounter this beast, Humbaba. And they have a kind of strange encounter with him involving dreams and prophecies and various things like that. But since this is, after all, a hero story, they end up triumphing and slay Humbaba. And they chop down the forest, bring it back, and build the city. Now, there are many, many interesting details and so on about Gilgamesh, which you can go into, but just think of that basic idea that this is what a hero does. A hero goes out into the forest, chops it down, and builds his city. And that kind of story of the hero story, we still find variations of that in modern times as well. Think of something like, say, The Hobbit. Basically the same story, right? Bilbo Baggins goes to the mountain. This time it's not logging, it's mining. Right? He's extracting the precious metals from the earth and slaying the spirit, the chthonic spirit of the earth, who's protecting it. Because we think that Smaug is a bad guy, right? But actually, he's a version of this spirit or deity of nature who's protecting the wilderness. So this is the hero's journey. Now, in modern times, in the last few decades, of course, the idea of the hero's journey has become very well known thanks to Joseph Campbell's work. And he wrote this book, The Hero of a Thousand Faces, where he showed that this idea of the hero's journey is found very commonly across all different cultures. If you haven't read it, you should read it. It's a really interesting and powerful book. One of the things which is interesting about it, The Hero of a Thousand Faces is arguably the most influential book published in the 20th century. It's been so influential across so many different areas. And, you know, apart from anything else, has been the kind of the main template for Hollywood since Star Wars. So basically all the big Hollywood movies are constructed according to the hero's journey. So that's like really influential. And there's something meaningful about this. You can't kind of dismiss it or say it doesn't mean anything, because obviously these are stories that touch a lot of people's lives. People obviously relate to it in some way, right? So questions about whether it's good or bad are kind of beside the point, right? It is, and it's obviously connects with something in humanity in some way. Now, something which I think is curious, and it's almost, as far as I know, completely ignored in the Buddhist community. I literally don't know anybody apart from myself who's ever actually noticed this, but one of the main sources for Joseph Campbell's hero archetype is the Buddha. And he talks about the Buddha in most of the chapters and the sections on his outline of the hero. Now, Joseph Campbell, in fact, was a student of a Sanskritist called Heinrich Zimmer, who was one of the foremost students in Indology in the mid-20th century. Zimmer was a Jew who fled to Germany in the 30s, came to the States, and wrote an incredible series of writings on mythology and Indian philosophy. He was really one of the true greats of studies of mythology and especially Indian philosophy, but then he died, unfortunately, quite young. And Joseph Campbell then edited his, published his works, his writing at that time. If you ever get a chance to read them, you really should. Anyway, so point being that Joseph Campbell wasn't just a kind of a dilettante in this area, right? He had studied with one of the foremost Indologists and really knew what he was talking about when it came to things like the life of the Buddha. His sources for that was based on a later text, primarily called the Lalita Vistara. But most of what, I wrote a book a number of years ago called White Bones, Red Rock, Black Snakes. And in that book I showed that most of the stages of the hero's journey can actually be sourced back to the early Buddhist texts. So even though they're not sort of arranged sort of coherently in a hero's journey like that, but most of the episodes appear here and there. So what does that mean? Well, we can interpret that how we like, but the basic pattern, I think, is clear that the Buddha's life story is told as a hero's journey. And you can see that, you know, it basically fulfills that same pattern where the hero is staying at home, they have some urge to leave the home, they go out into the wilderness, they overcome various obstacles in the wilderness, they win a prize, and having won the prize, they then come back to enrich and improve their home or the place that they came from. And this is the kind of the basic pattern of the hero's journey, and the distinct feature about the Buddha's journey is that in many of the hero journeys, the prize that they're fighting for is something material, like Gilgamesh was fighting to chop down the forest or something, and so we can read it as an allegory for psychological or spiritual development. But in the Buddha's life story, it's not an allegory, right? It's obviously directly about psychological and spiritual development. So that's really the main difference, but the basic outline of the story is the same. Now, here's the thing, that this whole hero's journey thing, it's very blokey.
Can you make that into American English?
Dudish.
Bromish.
Right?
Bromance.
Well, I mean, the Enkidu and Gilgamesh is like the archetypal bromance. So how would you translate into that into American? Anyway, you get the idea, right? So it's a whole kind of bloke thing. you can learn some Australian while you're here. Expand your horizons. Right, so this whole kind of bloke thing, right? You go leave the home, you go out, you do all these adventures, get all these things, and basically no one cares what's happening at home. Right? Meanwhile, the poor old missus is back at home, cooking the meals, cleaning the house, looking after, raising the kids, you know, doing that kind of boring stuff, which the story isn't really interested in, right? So one of the things that I started looking at when I started reflecting on this is that, well, it's a kind of low-key story. Like you see, and see even like these days, people will kind of reform that, kind of recognize that. But you recognize that often by putting a woman in that bloke's role, right? So you have like Wonder Woman, right? But she does basically the same kind of thing, right? It's the same kind of story. So I started asking the question, like, is there another kind of story which is telling about these things from a different perspective? And of course, I'm not the first one to raise that question. I was thinking about one of the greatest hero myths in mythology, of course, is the story of Odysseus. Mm. And story of Odysseus is very interesting. It's basically a two-part, like the original and the sequel. And in the original, it's a fairly straightforward story. The Iliad, they're basically a bunch of bros, a bunch of blokes, get together, sacrifice the odd virgin, and then head out over the seas to go to war. Have the war, basically win it, okay. fine. But the story kind of ends more or less there. They don't end up going home, right? And so the Odysseus takes over from there and then talks about going home. Now, Odysseus was quite distinct from the other heroes of the time because he was the clever one. Right? He was the one who thought of the whole Trojan horse thing. And so the next 10 years of the story is him going to war and then another 10 years getting home again. And it's got many, many different, you know, adventures and so on, and meeting the Cyclops and says, you know, all these kinds of things. So it's a complicated story about coming home. But the interesting thing about the Odyssey is that it's interested in what Odysseus' wife is doing. Right? So Penelope, the missus, is sitting at home weaving a cloth. You know, very common domestic job. That is the job done by women very commonly down through the ages. And the story goes that after she'd been there for a while, sort of because she was looking after this large estate and all of this property, so all of these other blokes started saying, well, look, your husband's been away. He's obviously been killed at the war. So how about it, right? And so all of these suitors were coming and trying to win her hand. And so she kept on trying to put them off. And so how she would put them off was she would tell them, look, I will choose a husband when I finished weaving this cloth. And so during the day, she would weave this cloth, and then during the night, she would unpick it. And the most realistic detail of the whole story is that none of the blokes ever noticed that she was unpicking it. Please come in. So again, there's many interesting things and many interesting details in that story, but consider Odysseus' fate. He went around the whole of the ocean doing all of these battles and triumphs and losses and things like that, and at the end of the day, he loses everything. His ships are gone, his men are all dead, he's lost all of his treasure, everything that he's won. He's naked, alone, in the middle of a storm, in the middle of the ocean, just clinging to a piece of driftwood. That's where you end up. And he's sitting there and he's like, 20 years I've been doing this. This is all I've got, right? All of the things that he's been through, all of the adventures, and then he's just got nothing. Yeah? So then he gets cast up on the shore, and there he is on the shore, and the girls from the local palace come down to do the laundry. They're by Nausicaa. And they're coming down and they're playing and singing and having a nice time as they do the washing and the laundry. And one of the interesting little details about the Odyssey is that some critics have noticed that the Odyssey is fairly vague and general when it's talking about things like shipping and fighting and stuff like that, but it's very detailed and specific when it's talking about things like weaving and doing the laundry. And they speculated about whether it was in fact written by a woman, perhaps some say even written by Nausicaa, who's the girl who found him on the shore. But that's more kind of speculative. But what's more interesting from a literary point of view is to notice how it's kind of shifting your attention away from the traditional themes of mythology, right? The fighting and the battle, to something which is a bit different. So they find these girls doing the laundry, and when they see Ulysses, they clothe him. They wrap him in clothes. And remember, sort of how, look how these symbols are all playing around, because Penelope's weaving the cloth, and it's not until she's finished weaving the cloth that he can come home. See? And so it's not until he's lost everything that he's gained, and then he can be clothed. And that's when he can finally come home. So one begins to wonder if Penelope is perhaps not something more than she appears. Because one of the roles of a goddess is to weave the fates. And she's sitting there in her home, weaving the fates of everybody around her, all of the suitors, her husband. So this is giving us something, this is giving us an interesting kind of indication or interesting hint as to what kind of thing that might really be happening when we talk about the hero's journey. I wonder whether, it's purely speculative, but I wonder whether the real reason that Odysseus left the home for all that time was not because he wanted to go on an adventure, but because she wanted to get rid of him. Maybe she wasn't good enough for her. Maybe she was like, this guy needs to kind of learn a thing or two. Get out in the world. Maybe. Perhaps she didn't even feel safe with him in the house because he was a kind of drunken, brawling idiot. Right? Get out there in the world, learn a thing or two, meet some men, accomplish some things, lose some stuff, figure out that actually I'm the one that you should be respecting and valuing, and all of that stuff that you're going out in there in the world that you think is so exciting is all going to let you down. Like I said, purely speculative. There's an interesting cycle of stories which we find only in Indian mythology. And as far as I know, there are some hints to it, like that one I just gave, but it's not really, I've never found this particular story cycle or this particular story format told in any non-Indian mythology. If I've missed any, then let me know. And this storytelling motif revolves around a concept or an idea called Dohala. I think in, how do they say it in how do they say it in Sinhala these days? I think Dohaduka, is that right? Anyway, they sort of, the idea is still in Sri Lanka, I can't remember how it's actually pronounced. Anyway, so Dohala is a woman's pregnancy craving. Okay? It's not actually always associated with pregnancy, especially in the, yeah, you know? Dholaduka. Dholaduka. So it's not always necessarily, especially in the Buddhist tales, associated with pregnancy, but it's something like that. I'll give you an example of some stories revolving around Dohara. We find Dohara stories widely spread in Indian mythology, Hindu, Jain, and Buddhist. I'll tell a few Buddhist stories. And we find the story told at different kinds of levels. So I'll begin with a very simple level. And so this story revolves around a happily married couple of crocodiles living in the Ganges. And there they were, just living their nice crocodile life, until Mrs. Crocodile says, darling, I have this dohala, this craving, wish, this yearning. And the husband says, what is it, my dear? Anything you like, I shall get it for you. She says, I must have the beating heart of a monkey. And the husband says, but my dear, the monkeys live up on the shore. They're very fast and quick-witted animals. They're bouncing around the trees. I'm a crocodile. We live in the river. I can't possibly catch a monkey. And the wife says, my dear, you must get a monkey. If you don't get me the heart of a monkey, I shall die right here. And she lies down. Well, I guess she's a crocodile, so she's kind of always lying down. She lies down, and she's not going to move until she gets what she wants. And the husband, resigned, goes out to try to win the heart of a monkey. So he finds a monkey and he decides to trick him. And so, a bit like Wily Ulysses, who, or Odysseus, who wins by power of his wit, right? The crocodile tries to outwit the monkey. Spoiler, it's not going to end well. So, the crocodile says to the monkey, "Oh, monkey, how are you going?" "Oh, I'm going fine, good sir crocodile. How are you?" He says, "Good." He said, and the crocodile says, "What are you doing today?" And the monkey says, "Well, I'm eating these bananas on this shore." And the crocodile says, "Well, which do you prefer? Do you prefer bananas or mangoes?" And the monkey says, "Well, mangoes are obviously much tastier." And the crocodile says, "Why don't you eat the mangoes on the other side of the river?" And the monkey says, "Well, I can't. The river's very broad. I can't get across." And the crocodile says, "It's a very difficult problem. I tell you what, how about you jump on my back and I'll take you across?" And the monkey says, but Sir Crocodile, you will surely eat me." And the crocodile says, "Oh no, good monkey, I would never do that, I promise." So the monkey says, "All right." And he takes him halfway across the canyon. He's saying, "Wouldn't you believe it? The crocodile was lying all along," and he says to the monkey, "Aha, now I will eat you and I will take your heart and feed it to my wife." The heart of the monkey. And the monkey says, "Well, good sir crocodile, I suppose that's it, my time is up." But he said, "You know, I'm afraid that this your plan isn't going to quite work." And the crocodile says, "Why not?" He said, "Well, you know, monkeys, we're always jumping up and down in trees, right? And so because we're always jumping up and down in trees, our hearts get bounced around inside our chests. So usually what we do is we take our hearts out and we keep them out, we hang them in the trees for the day before we go jumping around." And he pointed to a fig tree and all these figs are hanging off the tree. He says, "There's all our hearts hanging there." "Oh," said the crocodile. And the monkey says, "Don't worry, just look, take me back to the shore, let me off, I'll go grab my heart and I'll be back in a jiffy." And so the crocodile does that, monkey jumps off, goes, picks a fig and starts eating it and starts laughing at the crocodile. "You fool, you thought that we leave our hearts out." So then poor Mr. Crocodile has to go home to face his wife. That was not pleasant. So this is one of the stories, the idea of the Dohala story. And in that story, you can see the outline of the idea. The woman has a wish or a desire, the man goes out, and basically he's doing the hero's journey. Right? The crocodile is doing the hero's journey there, leaving the home, going out, facing all these adversities. I mean, it's only a very sort of abbreviated version of it, but that's basically the outline. In that case, he failed, but that's not always the case. And so the hero's journey is actually, I mean, it's the bloke who's doing the hero's journey, but it's the Shila who's sending him out. We can say Shila because it's Sanskrit for virtue. You know what Shila means? No?
It's a woman in Australia.
Yeah, it's a woman in Australia. Yeah, good. Thank you. So the Shila's sending him out, but it's her... He's fulfilling her quest. I'll tell you another version. So, in this next version, there is a couple, an outcast, and two outcasts who are living on the outskirts of a city. And even though they're very poor, they didn't have anything to eat or anything like that. But I mean, sorry, they didn't have much possessions and things like that. They got by, they were okay. But one day the wife said to the husband, "My dear," she said, "I have a dohala, I have a yearning." And he said, "Whatever it is, my darling, anything that you wish for, I will get." And she said, "Well, I would very much like to eat a mango." And husband said, "My dear, of course I would get you a mango if it were possible, but it's not the mango season. There's no mangoes around. It's simply impossible." And so one time I was talking about this with a group of Buddhist scholars, and it came to this kind of bit, and there was one of the people who were there was a young couple who'd only recently been married and the wife was pregnant. And when I, this was a few years ago when I was visiting, I was in Atlanta. And when I said this, then this couple just started laughing. And they said, actually, you won't believe it, but yesterday my husband had spent the whole day traveling around looking for a mango. So the husband's like, there's no mangoes, it's out of season. So the wife says, but my dear, that's not my concern. I must have a mango. If I don't have a mango, I shall lie down here until I die. And so that's what she does. And then he remembers, in the king's garden, there's a magic mango tree that, according to legend, fruits all year round. Nobody's ever seen this tree or eaten the mangoes from it. Right? In fact, it's forbidden. It's death to set foot in the king's garden. But what choice does he have? So he waits until night, sneaks in, climbs the wall, sneaks through the king's garden, evading the guards, climbs up the tree. It takes him such a long time to get there and to climb up the tree that by the time he's ready to leave, the sun's coming up already. So he thinks, well, look, I'll just stay here, I'll just wait until the day has passed, and then in the morning I'll take the mango and I'll take it for my wife. So there he is waiting. Now, soon after the dawn has broken, he hears a noise, and then through the along the path is coming the king and his Brahmin, who's his minister, and the guards. And they come and they sit under the magic mango tree, right underneath where the outcast is sitting. And when they sit down, the king sits on a high seat. The Brahmin, who is his teacher, sits on a low seat. All right? So there's the Brahmin sitting on the ground, the king sitting above him, and the outcast sitting above them all, right, in the tree. This is one of the things these stories do, is they turn the order of the world upside down. And the Brahmin starts educating the king about statecraft and the rules and the virtues and duties of a king and so on. And while he's doing that, the outcast in the tree above is getting more and more outraged. He's thinking, this king really is not doing the right thing. He should be respecting his teacher. I mean, look, fair enough, he's the king. If he's sitting in his throne room, let him sit on a high throne, that's fine. But here he is, receiving teachings from his teacher. He should really be sitting on a low seat and showing respect for his teacher. And the outcast becomes so outraged with this that he leaps out of the tree and stands in front of them and starts scolding the king. Immediately the guards rush in and they're about to chop his head off. The king says, wait a minute, let's hear this fellow out. And the outcast explains what he said. And the king thinks about it for a minute and says, you know, actually you're right. Now, I was treating my teacher with disrespect because what he was teaching me was about the truth. He was teaching me about what was good. And I should show respect for that. And so he said to the outcast, he says, we won't kill you for that. He said, in fact, because of the courage and integrity that you've shown, I want to invite you to come and join me in the palace and to rule beside me. Now, if you had been from a high caste in society, I would have appointed you to be the king in my stead. But because you're an outcast, I can't do that. And instead, what I'll do is I'll appoint you to be the king of the night. Yeah. Very nice title, right? Mm-hmm. The king of the night. And so the outcast was made the king of the night. His wife was invited, they came, they lived in the palace, she became the queen of the night, and they could enjoy mangoes all year round. So in that story, again, you can see the similar kind of idea, the same pattern, right? The husband is doing the hero's quest, he's returning. It's all because of what the wife is wanting. But this one is successful. Right? This one, he succeeds in his quest, and because he succeeds in his quest, there is a transformation, a positive transformation. Right? There is an abundance. Right? This is what is the outcome of these stories, is an abundance. They can have mangoes whenever they like. The whole nation is prospering. And the abundance comes because accepted into that rulership is the night, aka the unconscious, aka all of those things that we normally don't want to look at. And they're accepting that those rules of the daytime, right, the rules that the Brahman was teaching in the daytime, the rules of law and the rules of rationality and all of those things, these are part of kingship, yes. He's going to stay in that role of kingship, but also the rules of sneakiness, of how to find what you need, and those unknowable, irrational impulses and desires, they're also part of humanity. And that's also been acknowledged and made part of the kingship. So this is how these stories will... they start out with something very simple, but they reach into something which is actually quite profound. And in these stories we're seeing a lot of what are classical mythological motifs, things like the sacrifice of the king, or the sacred tree, the inversion of the values of the world order, of suspension, like when the outcast is in the tree, he's suspended between the heaven and the earth. So these are all classical mythical motifs. You can find in books like Fraser's The Golden Bough. And so it's in that state of suspension, that state of being in between, that potential arises. When everything is always sorted out into its binaries, right and wrong, good and bad, high caste and low caste, then everything's static. And so when things are disrupted, turned upside down, and suspended, then a new order of flourishing and abundance can appear. So the highest form that this story takes is a form that really approaches the scope of a grand myth. And this is the story of the golden peacock, the golden deer, sometimes the six-tusked elephant, the Chardanta Jataka, which is one of the greatest of all the Jataka stories. Now in this story, and I'll just basically summarize these stories, because they're told again in a variety of places, all of which have their different variations. But the basic idea is that you have a queen whose name is Kama. Queen whose name is Kama. And the word Kama means sanctuary. And the origins of the word Kama come from the ancient Indo-European peoples who were pastoral nomads. And in the grassy plains of Central Asia, they would wander with their herds of cattle, sometimes raiding villages or whatever, but leading quite a hard life. And then at the end of the day's journey, then they would come to an oasis, to a watering place, and they could feed their beasts, unyoke their beasts, rest, drink water, eat, and sit around the fireplace telling each other stories. And this is where the origin of the word Kama comes. Of course, in Buddhism, Kama is a synonym for Nibbana. So this queen is called Kama, sanctuary. And many queens or princesses or whatever in stories, then she's probably more concerned with just the having a nice gown to wear or something like that. Until one day she has a dream, and in this dream she dreams that a golden beast, a golden peacock or a golden deer, comes to her and teaches her the Dhamma. And then it leaves. She wakes from the dream, and as she wakes from the dream, she calls out, "Come back to me, golden peacock. Come back to me, golden peacock." And the serving girls hear her say that and laugh. Oh, the queen's going a bit nutty. But she knows she's not going crazy. She knows that she saw this golden peacock. And so she lies down on the couch. And the king comes to see her and says, "My dear, what's the matter?" She said, "I had a dream." He said, "Really?" She said, "In my dream, a golden peacock came and taught me the Dhamma." And he said, "Oh, that's so nice, my darling. I'm glad that you have a lovely dream." And she said, "No, you don't understand. I must have the heart of the golden peacock. And the king says, but my dear, there's no such thing as the golden peacock. They don't exist. It's just a vision you saw in your dream. And she said, if I do not get the heart of the golden peacock, I shall lie down here until I die. So, the king. And so it's the kind of thing that this whole story is set in motion by this indomitable will. Completely irrational, right? No regard for reason or anything like that. I must have it. And so the king's like, well, how can I do this? How can I find it? So he asks around the court, has anybody heard of the golden peacock? No. He consults the most learned Brahmins. And they say, yeah, there's this ancient text that somebody talked about once where someone mentioned a golden peacock, but, you know, it's just way off in history. It's not really, it's just a legend. Nobody's heard of one. He asks everybody until finally he calls into his court the hunters, the lowest caste in society, the wild men who make a living by going out and killing beasts, right? The most brutal and vicious of men. He calls them and says, has anyone heard of a golden peacock in all your journeys around the country? Until the last of the hunters, the most ugly and violent of all of them, says, yes, I've heard of a golden peacock. And so the king tasks him with the quest of finding the golden peacock. Now, of course, the golden peacock lives in the furthest reach of the mountains. Now, the golden peacock has its own backstory. In fact, the golden peacock is the bodhisattva. Plot twist, right? It's a dark story. The hero is always the bodhisattva. And he, because he was so beautiful and so powerful, he was born into this herd of peacocks and used to look after them. They were under threat because the hunters kept on coming for them. This is why the hunter knew about it. They wanted to capture this golden peacock. And so because of that, he knew he couldn't protect his people as long as he was there. So the golden peacock fled and went on retreat into the deepest place in the mountains, right? Basically into his man cave, right? Right? So this is, again, all of these things are really interesting storytelling motifs, right? Because it touches that thing that so many of us feel. Like, we feel like we can't cope, we can't do this, we can't do all the things that people expect of us, so we might as well just go and hide away in a little meditation retreat, but stay for a few days and no one's going to bother me. Hypothetically speaking. And then he goes and he's in the forest. And one of the nice details about this story with the golden peacock is that when he comes out, he sings a verse every morning. He sings a verse in homage to the sun. And this verse that he's singing in homage to the sun is just like pure Vedic sun worship, right? There's no adulteration or even pretense at this being Buddhist. It's like homage to the great sun and so on. And then afterwards they put another verse saying, and oh yeah, by the way, also homage to the Buddhas and all of the Arahants and so on. So they just like kind of stick a Buddhist verse in there after the Brahmanical verse to sort of make it look Buddhist, right? And okay, so the peacock's out there, and he's protected by his divine mantras and by the power of his paramis and so on. And the hunter, of course, has to, you know, cross the uncrossable river and penetrate the impenetrable forest and climb the unclimbable mountain and defeat the undefeatable beast and all of those kinds of things, whatever adventures he has to go through. In fact, one of those stories is in the Chandanta Jataka. It's very interesting. It's the most detailed one. And in the Chandanta Jataka, it actually gives detailed and specific abseiling instructions. Like, it gives him like all of the abseiling equipment he needs, like picks and rope and all of these kinds of things, putting it in a backpack, organizing all of the materials, going out, and then how to hammer it in, tying on the ropes and climb up. Incredible. It's like the first description
of
abseiling, like mountaineering.
Oh.
Yeah. And so... And he even has a hang glider or a parachute to get down the other side. So anyway, eventually he gets there and he meets the beast, and his job is to kill the beast and to take the heart. well. Turns out to be a bit trickier than he thought. So again, the different versions of this are told in different ways, and each version has its own interest. So I don't want to linger on it too long. But at the end of the day, the hunter fails in his task, fails to kill the beast, because he realizes this beast is too beautiful and too wise. I can't kill him. And at the end of that long journey, even that most vicious and brutal of men finds compassion and love in his heart. And when he finds compassion and love in his heart, of course, that's what the real meaning of the heart of the golden peacock is. So remember right back to the beginning, even the very sort of childlike version of the story with the crocodile and the monkey, you're looking for the heart of the monkey. But the moral of the story, of course, is brain over brawn, right? The monkey is clever and beats the crocodile. So even there, the heart of the monkey really is the monkey's wit and intelligence. Same thing in this thing. The heart of the golden peacock is the Dhamma teaching, the teaching of compassion and love. And when he does that, when he realizes that, then miraculously all of the beasts who are held in captivity all across India are freed. Everyone in captivity is released. All of the abundance appears all across the world. And that, of course, is the real meaning of Kama. In some of those stories, they even have the idea of a covenant between man and beast. So the farmers who have their crops, the farmers are told that they aren't to kill the deer anymore. But then they complain to the king because the deer keep coming and eating their crops. This actually happens in Bodhinyana with the kangaroos, because all the kangaroos jump inside the monastery because we're not going to hurt them or shoot them or anything. And then they jump out and eat all the grass on the neighbor's field. So, yeah. And so they make a deal between the men and the deer to put up signs on the fields. So whenever the deer see these signs, then they won't come and eat the crops. So this is that story, and this is the outcome of that story. The outcome of the story, the hero myth has been wrapped up, not because the hero is going out to get there because he wants to get what he wants, to chop down the forest and mine the land and do all those kinds of things, but he's sent out because of her wish, her desire, her need, and the outcome of that is not conquest and destruction, but the outcome of that, if he listens to her, is abundance and flourishing. Right? So like I said, that version of the hero myth is, as far as I'm aware, only found in Indian storytelling. But to me, it says and it speaks to something which is very profound and very powerful. Story is just story. So story itself doesn't really mean anything. I mean, it will mean a different thing to everybody here. That's fine. It has multiple different meanings. Itself, it doesn't mean anything. But one of the things about this story that I really kind of noticed, and you look at like how we apply it and how we understand it today, you know, we have this idea of the hero myth going out into the wilderness, conquering nature. And you have to ask yourself, do we really need that kind of story anymore? Haven't we chopped down enough forests? Haven't we dug up enough mountains? Do we even have a wilderness anymore? I mean, if you look at like the great heroes like Gilgamesh, one of the motifs that Gilgamesh has in common with Hercules is that they're often depicted in the iconography with the head or the jaws of a lion, okay, as their kind of helmet, right? So they kill a lion, skin it, and wear the pelt. I mean, in those days, that's kind of impressive, right? Going toe-to-toe with a lion and coming back alive. But these days, you know, who's the kind of guy who poses pictures of themselves on Facebook standing next to a lion that they've shot, right?
Trump's son.
Yeah.
I did not say that. I was going to, but yes. Perhaps not the icon of heroism that we need in this day and age. I don't know. So something that was a heroic quest these days is just awful. This is horrible. So why are we still telling ourselves this story about the hero? And why are our, you know, cinemas still full of superhero stories telling us the same thing, going out and winning battles and those kinds of things? So I started to wonder, what is the modern version of that story, of that woman's story? So the woman's story is to not go out, but to stay home and to win the battle in the home. Now, all of these stories are culturally embedded, right? So it's not about saying that that's where women should be. It's just saying that these are the stories that women, that cultures have tended to tell about women and that women have told about themselves. Many of these stories, there's a wonderful book by Marina Warner called From the Beast to the Blonde, which if you're interested in these things, I strongly recommend. And she wrote about how many of these kinds of stories were passed down by women in sewing circles. And this was, you'd sit around and you'd tell each other stories while you're weaving. So there's a whole kind of genre of stories, Sleeping Beauty, Rapunzel, Cinderella. Bluebeard, where the quest of the woman is not to defeat the monster out there in the wilderness, but to defeat the monster in the home. And obviously, this has a number of fairly obvious implications, right? Obviously, it is a metaphor for how do you cope with this big, weird, hairy beast that's somehow inhabiting your home, right? And all of the fears of domestic violence, of rape, of death in childbirth, right? Which these stories help to cope with that and help with that. And the modern inheritor, I think, of these stories is the horror movie or the horror story. And in the horror story, typically, you don't go out into the wilderness to overcome the beast, right? But the most scary words that you can possibly hear, it's coming from inside the house. It's coming from inside the house. So, in a horror movie, much like in the stories of the Dohala, the outcome is not necessarily to win anything or to get anything. The outcome is to just survive. The winner of the horror movie is the one who lives. And so, I think that this has a very particular resonance with the times that we're living in today. Actually, there is no wilderness. There is no outside. We've turned the whole world into our house. And the horror is inside the house. And the monster is here with us. And the monster is not the other that's over there. The monster is the one who's here. And whether you know, you can see that in psychological terms, you can do that. If you can see it in domestic terms, you can do that. If you can see it in political terms, then you can do that. But the idea remains basically the same. The real monster is the one in the house. And so what we do is we keep on developing these narratives that create a sense of otherness and that create an external monster. So the monsters are the terrorists, the monsters are the Muslims, the monsters are black people, the monsters are Russians, the monsters are anything that we want to describe as other. And all of these are there to foster, all these narratives are there precisely to foster hate, to foster division, to tear people apart. Because if the scariest words in a horror movie are it's coming from inside of the house, then the nadir of a horror movie, the point of peak idiot, is when somebody says, let's split up. And when somebody says, let's split up, you know bad things are going to happen. And yet somebody always does it. Let's split up. So if there's something that we can learn from this, then perhaps that's it. Perhaps don't listen to the idiot in the room who's telling us to split up. Perhaps we should start thinking of our quest not in terms of the way that the world has given us this idea based on a hero myth, that our quest is to go out there to get a career, to get a life, to get a salary, to get an income, to win all the things, right, and to have all the things. But perhaps our quest is to live. And living in our age of climate crisis, in our age of all of the horrors that are looming, living will, I think, be the greatest accomplishment that we can do. Can we survive? So typically in a horror movie you have the final girl, the one who lives. That's the hero. So do you feel stressed enough yet? Or should I keep going? Okay, let me leave it at that. And